From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Someone had tipped Becca Heller off, so she knew some kind of immigration travel ban was coming in the brand new Trump administration, and she got to work. Heller is an activist and a lawyer who co-founded an organization that specializes in providing legal assistance to refugees. She had a network of lawyers and legal experts, so she reached out, asked them to head to airports and see if they could help. And they did, as you probably know, setting up makeshift legal offices in lobbies and waiting areas, filling out forms, reassuring panicked people who didn't know what was going to happen or what they should do. Becca Heller is in Utah today. She's joining us to talk about the stories of the people forced to leave home and what it's like to be caught up in an often tortuous process. Join us after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Primary Children's Hospital. They've been recognized by U.S. News and World Reports for care in all 10 pediatric specialties, including heart, orthopedics, neurology, and cancer. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you saw the TV news stories at the airports the day President Trump signed his order barring from entry people coming from seven Muslim-majority countries, it looked spontaneous, like immigration lawyers and legal experts had just heard the news and headed to airports. And it may have happened like that for some, but what gets lost in the story is that all of those lawyers filling out forms and reassuring people was part of a strategy mapped out in part by Becca Heller. Heller co-founded an organization that provides legal services to refugees. It's kind of an ingenious program, really, that taps the services of students and professionals around the country. And when she got word that Trump's ban was coming soon, she reached out to that network. And that's what you saw in those reports. Becca Heller is in Utah today. She's joining us to talk about the human and legal rights for immigrants and refugees. We'll also talk about what it's like for people forced to leave home, about the political tradition, the American tradition of letting people in, and how the political landscape may be changing all of that. Becca Heller is the director and the co-founder of the International Refugee Assistance Project. She's going to be giving a speech or talking anyway at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. We'll give you details about that a little bit later in the program, but she's joining us here in the studio. And welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can we start with the travel ban day? I just wanted to get a sense of what that was like for you.
I've blocked it out completely.
So did you get a tip that this was coming?
Sure. So here's how this went down.
Yeah.
You know, President Trump gets inaugurated on Friday, January 20th.
Yep.
He takes the weekend off to go golfing.
Right. Yeah.
He has promised a number of things that he's going to pass by executive order across like a myriad of topic areas, immigration being one of them, but yep. Another being this Muslim ban or a ban on Syrian refugees. So we know something's coming, but we don't know when. Monday morning, we get leaked a photo of a monitor, of a, like a desktop computer monitor in the White House that has the text of the Muslim ban on it.
Wow.
It says, you know, basically they're banning people from seven countries. They're banning Syrian refugees. They're freezing the refugee program. So we don't know when precisely it's coming out, but it's clearly imminent and at the top of the agenda. So we, you know, we had a bunch of clients who had valid visas but hadn't traveled yet. And we called all of our clients and we said,
get on a plane.
Get on a plane,
yeah.
Right? That's sort of the, you know, sort of
who paid for that, by the way?
Some of the clients were able to pay for it themselves and the rest were covered by law firm partners of ours.
Wow.
And then at some point during the week, we realized that at any given time when the travel ban came down.
Wait, you didn't know exactly when it would go down?
No one knew when it would. Everyone thought it was going to be Wednesday when General Kelly was sworn in as the Secretary of Homeland Security.
Yeah.
That was like the conventional wisdom was that this would be announced sort of in celebration of having a new DHS secretary. We're going to ban a lot of people from coming to America.
Right.
You know, as in the American tradition of turning away, you know, our tired, our poor, et cetera. So no one knew when exactly. It was just clear that it was imminent. And we've now seen that this is a game that this administration likes to play, right? Like, I'm going to make a decision on the Paris Accord. It might be tomorrow. Like, let's keep it. He's the master of suspense. But the upshot was that at some point it was going to come down and there were going to be thousands of people, not just refugees, but travelers, you know, in the air who, when they took off from their point of origin, had legal permission to enter the U.S. and when they landed in the U.S. no longer did. And nobody knew what was going to happen to them. So we thought that there probably needed to be a bunch of lawyers waiting at the airport on the off chance. And as it turned out, this is what happened, that thousands of people were just detained upon arrival.
Yeah. You know, I have to say that this seems like a weird comparison, but it seemed to me like that day was, you know, like that scene from A Wonderful Life when
I haven't seen it.
Okay. The banks crash and George Bailey goes in and he has this money and it's just – it's chaos, but they work through the day one case at a time, one thing at a time until they work it all through. I mean, did it seem chaotic and exhausting?
It seemed chaotic, but not like one thing at a time.
Yeah, really?
Well, so in the end, it came down on a Friday afternoon. Yeah. It came down at 4:30 p.m.-ish on Friday, January 27th. And there was like this, you know, to use an overused metaphor, like calm before the storm, where just like for a few hours, nothing happened. And I put my daughter to bed at 8 p.m. And then about 20 minutes later, I got a call that one of our clients, his name is Hamid Darwish, he actually worked for 10 years as an interpreter for the U.S. military in Iraq. He worked on a forward operating base, which, among other things, means that every 6 months he received a military-grade level security clearance. So Hamid had had a minimum of 21 military-grade level security clearances saying that he was not a threat to the U.S. When he landed at JFK with his wife and child, he was shackled, handcuffed, put in a cell, and told that he was being deported back to Iraq. So I got that call.
Where his life could be in danger.
In fact, there had been official findings. So he came over on a special visa that's meant to protect interpreters whose lives are in danger. So in his case, both the Department of State and the Department of Homeland Security, in order for him to get this visa, had made official findings that he was in life-threatening danger because of his work for the U.S. And then he came here and we, you know, shackled him to a table. And I got that call at 8:30 p.m. And I called a former professor of mine from law school, Mike Wishney. I called my friend Justin Cox at the National Immigration Law Center. And we stayed up all night basically writing this lawsuit saying, you can't deport people under this illegal executive order. We filed it at 5:30 in the morning because we wanted to get it filed before any flights departed on which people could be deported. And so our lawyers got to JFK Friday night, but I was sitting on my couch trying not to wake up my sleeping baby, you know, co-drafting this lawsuit. And I finally got to JFK around noon on Saturday, and I had no idea that there were that many people there.
Yeah.
Like, I had just been in this cave of lawsuit drafting when I showed up and I saw that there were thousands of people like chanting outside. I called my deputy legal director who was somewhere inside on the phone and I was like, what is happening? Like, who are these people? Like, what are they doing here? Like, I didn't know.
You must have felt amazed. Terrified and unsure, but I have to say, I think for a lot of people, it must have seemed incredibly inspiring to see people responding.
Yeah. I think in retrospect, I'm amazed.
Yeah.
At the time, I'd forgotten a coat.
And it was January.
It was January, and I, you know, we're not up in the mountains in New York, but like it gets cold,
yeah.
And so the things I remember feeling are freezing, adrenaline,
yeah.
And just sort of like when I'm faced with a crisis, I tend to just go on this emotional autopilot of like, what's next? What's next? So I saw the big crowd, and immediately I called someone else I knew who had connections to, like, the community organizing movement. And I was like, it turns out there's 4,000 people here. Like, I need someone who can organize them. Like, who can I talk to? And they hooked me up with this great organization called Make the Road. You know, but my mind was sort of already on, like, okay, there's a crowd here. What do we do with this?
Yeah.
You know?
All right, I want to back up.
Yes.
At what point did you start, like, as a student, as a kid, thinking of immigrants? And I mean, I know I'd read that you had been wanting to be at some point an immigration lawyer. And I'm wondering, like, when did that happen? Why? Was there a story? What was it?
I grew up in the East Bay in California, so we were really surrounded by immigrants. And I think I didn't realize really what a politically sheltered upbringing I had. You know, looking back, like all of our parents were really far to the left. But of course, we thought they were really moderate because they were our parents. Yeah. And like they were boring. Yeah. And, you know, and they believed stuff that was a little different than us. And I just had no sense really of... you know, I imagine these like enclaves of, you know, discrimination against LGBTI people or racism or, you know, just like taking place in like these rural tiny pockets of the U.S. that I truly had very little idea of how politically sheltered I was. So it didn't seem to me that there needed – I don't know. I wasn't thinking about immigrants' rights work. Like, I cared a lot about social justice work, but I think as a kid and growing up, the easiest to grasp manifestation of social injustice to me was homelessness.
Yeah.
And homelessness in California is very visible because it doesn't snow, so people can live on the streets. So I remember the first really inequality issue that I remember being really seized by, and I remember being taken by this even as like a tiny kid, like when we saw people begging and I would say, well, we have an extra room in our house. Can't they come stay in our house? And my parents were like, no. And I was like, you guys are so cruel and heartless. And immigration really came later.
Later, yeah. So there's this, you got this award in high school that I read about, most likely to debate with a teacher, which says what about your character? That kind of a contrary nature, or you just like to dig in and argue about stuff?
Probably both of those things.
Yeah.
I mean, I part of it for me was that I was really bored in school. And I think that arguing with teachers was a way to, you know, a selfish way to try to entertain myself. I think part of it, frankly, is that, like, a lot of the time teachers are just wrong. Like, I remember in fifth grade I got some question wrong on a science test. And I don't remember what it was. It had to do with, like, the time that some planet took to orbit around something else. And I got the test back. And I took it to the teacher. I was like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, my answer makes sense. And I was demonstrating with, like, pencils circling around something. And she pulled, you know, teachers have – there's, like, the textbook. And then there's the teacher's version of the textbook that has all the answers.
Yeah.
And she just kept being like, well, this is what the book says the answer is. And I was like, that's insane. Like, and I started a petition.
Because wait, how old were you?
Fourth grade.
Okay.
Wow. I read the Babysitter's Club books a lot, and then one of them they did a petition, so I went through this like petitioning phase where I was petitioning for everything until I like got all these signatures being like, this answer is wrong, and there was no point, obviously. And then I remember a couple of the locks on the stalls in the girls' bathroom were broken, so I did a petition for those, and I brought it to the principal, and this made a real I was still 10, and I remember her being like, I was Becky at the time. She was like, Becky, you could have just come to us and asked us to fix the locks.
You didn't need a petition.
You didn't need a petition. And I was like, huh.
All right. I'm interested in your gap. So you took this gap year.
By accident.
By accident?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
You
got into Dartmouth.
No.
No.
I applied early decision to two colleges, and they found out and rescinded their offers of admission.
Oh, yeah. You're not supposed to do that.
Well, I didn't know. I wasn't super tuned into the whole academic thing.
Yeah. So you accidentally took it. So you figured, I need to do something. So you went, so you did an AmeriCorps.
You know, I'd always been really seized by inequality issues, but I had done nothing about them. And I was thinking about just going to Berkeley because the University of California applications are due early, but you can literally walk to Berkeley from my parents' house. And that made me uncomfortable for a variety of reasons. And I was talking to my best friend on the phone, and he was sort of, and I'm paraphrasing, but he was basically like, look, you're always talking about how you want to help people. Here's your chance, right? Like, put your money where your mouth is. And he was probably nicer about it. But I was just like, okay. So I did AmeriCorps, and it was one of the best things that's ever happened to me. I mean, it was just, I think part of why I had never tried to address the inequality issues that bothered me so much is that I just didn't know how.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you look at something like homelessness and you're just like, what on, besides bringing this person home and putting them in our extra bedroom, like, what do you even do about this, especially as an 18-year-old?
Right.
And
you weren't thinking about it as a system or as, I mean, you weren't really breaking it down.
I mean,
then.
I think I was thinking about it as a system, but then it becomes even more overwhelming about, you know, what do I do? And I feel like people have that issue today with, like, you hear, you know, 65 million refugees and you just shut down.
Yeah.
Right. It's such a big number. Like, what could possibly be done about that? And I think as a person growing up who cared deeply about inequality but was sort of overwhelmed by the volume and complexity of it, I really didn't think there was anything I could do. And I give AmeriCorps like 100% credit for empowering me and educating me that there were a lot of things that I could do. And I think that I think everyone should take a gap year. I think it's better to do it on purpose because it's less emotional trauma than thinking that you're never going to college. But I just like I came to college with a real sense of sort of who I was and, you know, as much as you can have that at 19 and what I was about and what was important to me and also a sense of confidence, you know, that I could do things.
Were you determined then law school was in the cards?
No, I thought I wanted to teach, actually.
Really?
I was really obsessed with racial inequality in education. So in AmeriCorps, I was working at, it wasn't like an inner city school, but it was a very diverse school with all the problems that sort of come with diverse populations. And there was like a big element of urban poverty. And I had this like obsession with South Africa and the truth and reconciliation process. And I thought I wanted to teach. And I went to Dartmouth, and they have actually a teacher certification program that you can do as a like as an undergrad there, not even as a major. So I got certified to teach K through eighth grade social studies in New Hampshire. And then I remember getting the curriculum and reading through it and being like, I can't tell these things to children. Like, this is not true. Like, this is not really how our government works.
Wow.
So that was out. And then I had a number of different sort of phases of I had an affordable housing phase. I had a community food security phase. I spent 2 years living in sub-Saharan Africa. Then I did gay marriage for a year. I did gay marriage for a year. That sounds terrible. I like was lucky enough to get a job organizing for Freedom to Marry in Vermont.
I get it.
No, I just like for all your, you know, listeners out there who want to have gay marriages, or who have now had them, I guess.
Then
law school.
Then law school. Okay. So what did you know about the plight of refugees before 2008? Because this is when you go to Israel and then...
Nothing at all.
Okay, really?
Literally nothing. So I think people often conflate the terms refugee and asylum seeker.
Right.
The major difference is that an asylum seeker is inside a country trying to stay because they're saying, if I get sent back to where I'm from, I'm going to be persecuted.
Yep.
And a refugee is outside of a country trying to get in because they're saying, hey, I'm here and I'm being persecuted. Get me out. So I had done Yale Law allows you to start doing clinic, which means you work directly on cases your first year, which is really unusual and also awesome for people like me for whom, as you've gently pointed out, classroom learning is not a very good fit oftentimes. And so I had done the asylum clinic, and then I went to Israel, and I wasn't doing refugee work in Israel. I was doing something else. That I won't get into because I'm about to speak ill of the organization I was working at. But basically, they just didn't have enough for me to do. And so I was looking, and I really hate being bored. And I really hate being inefficient. And I hadn't been to the Middle East before, and I felt like I wasn't seeing anything. And I kept hearing about all these Iraqi refugees in Jordan. And I just thought, as an American citizen, maybe I should go meet them and just see, you know, what is the humanitarian fallout of my country's foreign policy?
Yeah. So you basically ditch the Israeli thing and go to Jordan.
Yes. Like a good Jew does. like my ancestors for 5,000 years of diaspora before me. I was like, this isn't working out. I'm going to go to another country.
So what did you see? Like, do you remember the first time you were kind of moved? I mean, basically there were like six...
Yeah.
Stories.
Oh, you've done your homework.
Yeah. That really moved you.
So I met with, basically I emailed, I didn't know, how do you, I was like, I want to meet Iraqi refugees in Jordan. Like, great.
What does that mean?
Well, how do you do that?
Exactly.
So I emailed just a ton of people, and through like a very attenuated chain, I was able to meet with six families, and I met with all of them in their living rooms. And in a lot of cases, you know, they're sleeping in the, like, the living room is one of the only rooms of their house. Like, they all sleep, like, there's couches and they convert into beds at night, and then there's a little kitchen off of it, and that's it. And I sat on the floor and I just heard people tell these harrowing stories, which I was at that point somewhat prepared for because I had seen a lot of harrowing things.
Yeah.
You know, I had done labor organizing in Nicaragua. I had performed like hospice care for HIV positive people like dying of Kaposi's sarcoma in Zimbabwe. Like I felt like somewhat inured to
horrible,
you know,
things.
Grotesque suffering, for lack of a better word. But what was really interesting to me was that out of all of the various social difficulties that people were having, and they were manifest, they all identified their primary problem as essentially a legal one, which was that, you know, they couldn't go back to Iraq because something really awful had happened to them or would happen to them or both. They couldn't stay in Jordan. Jordan is not a signatory to the UN Convention on Refugees, which means they don't recognize refugees. They can't work. They can't access like medical care in most cases. The kids can't go to school. In the cases where they can go to school, they're allowed to be what's called like passive learners. So they can sit in the back of the classroom and sort of absorb everything, but they can't raise their hand. And they certainly can't petition if they get an answer wrong on a test.
Right.
joke was just for you. I've never made it before.
It worked.
The arc of this interview went in a direction that allowed for it. But all of them were just like, you know, we can't go back to Iraq and we can't stay here. And we're trying to navigate this crazy system with the United Nations and the U.S. and Canada. And we don't know what's happening with our cases. We're on some kind of wait list. You know, everyone has like a neighbor's cousin's dog's owner's former lover who like was on the wait list and got a call eventually and got in a plane and went to Australia and was fine. So they're all just sitting around waiting for that call. And I think a thing I love about working with refugees is that they're really like they're a self-selecting group that's very action oriented, right? Like these are the people to whom something really heinous happened and their response to that was to get out of the country, which like is not an easy thing to do. You know, I mean, after the election, like I was very depressed and I managed to get out of bed and I went to the Brooklyn Public Library and I got my then 1-year-old daughter a passport because I was like, I've seen the road this goes down.
Wow.
Like she has a different last name than me. Like if things hit the fan and we have to go to Canada, I'm not going to let the lack of documentation prevent us from getting in because I have too many clients whom that has happened to. Like it is really hard to flee a country, you know, and that's just crossing the U.S.-Canadian border. Like you can imagine going from like Iraq to Syria to Jordan, which is the path that most of these people took. So it's people who have self-selected by, we call it, voting with their feet, and then now are just like haplessly waiting, you know, for someone to give them a call saying, you get to start again.
You know, what's interesting about – this is something you've talked about is you went and spoke with the U.S. Embassy. And this idea of – you were like, how does the wait list work?
Yeah.
Like, there's not really a wait list.
No, there's no wait list.
Like it's a myth.
Yes. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about that. And I talk about it a lot.
Yeah.
Because that was sort of the, you know, awakening moment for me. And my first reaction was to be like, evil bureaucracy, like lying about the wait list to placate people so that they don't get angry about, you know. And then the more I thought about it, the more I realized that that's not what was happening. That the wait list is a rumor created from within the refugee community itself, and I'm sure you seem like you've done your research on me, so you've probably read or heard me say this a couple times before, but your listeners haven't, so I'll say it again. You know, I think that when you live at the bottom of a deep, dark hole, you have to believe that there's some kind of light at the top, even if you have to invent what the light is. And it just struck me as really tragic that the best symbol of hope that this community could come up with was literally the epitome of a dysfunctional bureaucracy, right? Like a wait list by definition is a sign that something isn't processing people fast enough because otherwise there would be no wait list.
Yeah.
And that was the best hope that they had really moved me to try to do something about their plight.
There's this big question, it seems like, at the heart of all of this, and that is, why is it that someone would – why would they leave home? And there's this piece I like that you wrote for Foreign Policy, and you quote this line from this Somali-British writer, Warsan Shire. Would you talk a little bit about this? Because I kind of love this image. It shows how desperate people are.
Yeah, so the poem is called Home. And there's two lines that I like to quote from it, and I can't actually remember which one I used in the Foreign Policy piece.
What about the shark?
Oh, okay.
I'll prompt you.
I started laughing because of I sing a song about a shark with my daughter. And I was like, oh, I know a few, you know, lyrical things about sharks. But it's – I want to say the other line too, though, actually. I mean, the first line of the poem is, no one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. The other line that I think is really resonant from the poem that's been quoted a lot is, no one puts their child in a boat unless the water is safer than the land. And I think, you know, in America – like, unless you are American Indian, like, your family has been here for maybe 400 years, but probably not, right? Most of us are immigrants. My family came here in, like, the 1910s and 20s. We were lucky enough to sort of be forced out of Europe before World War II happened. But, you know, and then, like, they came to Chicago, and then my parents moved to California, like, 2 years before I was born. So, like, I still think of California as home, but I can trace my lineage there to, like, roughly 1979, right? For people in the Middle East, like, they can say, like, my family has been farming this piece of land for 3,000 years. Like, leaving it is, like, leaving home for any of us is so wrenching. I had a really interesting ride over here in the Lyft this morning where I was talking to the Lyft driver and I said, are you from Utah? And he said, yes, I was born here. And he said, I've been to all 50 states. I've spent a lot of time in Hawaii, but Utah is home. You know, I think that everyone has a really strong sense of what home is, and that when you add 3,000 or 5,000 years of history to this, because these are ancient societies, it makes it all the more heavy to leave. And you really don't leave unless you're escaping the jaws of a shark, you know, unless things are on fire.
Yeah.
And I think it's so hard to make that decision, and it's so brave to make that decision. And you don't make that decision if you have any other choice at all.
It kind of gets us to something I want to talk about when we get back from a break, and that is, you know, what seems to be this argument about what's a good immigrant, what's a bad immigrant, and this idea of merit, which I know you've been thinking a lot about.
Yes, the president has also been thinking about
it.
Tweeted about it again yesterday.
Yes, he did. We'll get to that. Becca Heller is with us, director and co-founder of the International Refugee Assistance Project. Tonight at 7 o'clock, she's going to be at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law for a conversation. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You listen to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Becca Heller is joining us. It was Heller who helped organize and mobilize thousands of lawyers who went to airports last year when President Trump first signed his travel ban. She says since the election, she's been thinking in military terms, seeing lawyers as troops to be deployed to protect the legal rights of refugees. She's in Utah today, speaking at the University of Utah S.J. Quinney College of Law. We'll give you details about that. She's joining us here in the studio to talk. I wanted to go back to that question of the good immigrant and the bad immigrant, because this is something that you've talked a little bit about. You point out the argument of whether the refugees in Europe that everyone's paying attention to, whether they're economic migrants or they're refugees, and you've talked about how that determination is like legally important. Talk about that. Why is this important?
So most of the countries on the planet, including the United States, have signed on to the 1951 Convention relating to the status of refugees, which says you can't deport someone who's going to be persecuted. And it defines persecution in a very specific and, frankly, outdated way because it was written after World War II to deal largely with the Jewish population that was displaced.
Yeah. In 51, it was written.
It was right. It was written in 51, and then the U.S. took until like 67 to sign on. But that's how we roll with international treaties.
Right.
At least we signed, which is more than I can say for certain other accords about climate. We'll just leave that there.
Yeah.
And that it defines a refugee as someone who's fleeing persecution, but it has to be targeted persecution that's after them, like, because of a particular characteristic. So it has to be because of their religion or their national origin or their race or that they're a member of a particular social group or their political opinion, which cuts out an awful lot of people who I would argue desperately need life-saving refuge in a way that at the time probably made sense to deal with the post-World War II displacement crisis, but is no longer applicable to the reasons that people flee. So a couple of really critical groups that it cuts out are people fleeing climate problems. So, you know, we've seen the New York Times actually did a piece on climate refugees from Louisiana. So we see that even within our own country. But if when the island of Tuvalu in the South Pacific gets submerged underwater in 2020, none of those people are going to be considered refugees, even though there's no way for them to go back home. And there's no legal framework for any country to sort of take them in that currently exists. Another group that it doesn't include is people fleeing generalized violence or civil war. So a lot of the people fleeing Syria who haven't been targeted specifically but who had to leave because their neighborhoods were being like carpet bombed or gassed with chemical weapons.
They're not included.
Technically might not be refugees if the chemical weapon didn't say like this is intended to land on Becca Heller's head because she has brown hair. And I think the last category is what people refer to as economic migrants, which I think gets a really inappropriately bad rap, as if like leaving a country where there's no jobs to make enough money to feed your family to undertake back-breaking, like horrible labor in like the industrial pesticide-filled agricultural fields of the U.S. in order to send money home so your kids can eat, like somehow makes you a bad immigrant. And it's the radio, but you can't tell, but I'm making air quotes.
Yeah, right.
I'm making on the air quotes.
You were sarcastic enough. That was good. Yeah.
So yeah, you have to. Sometimes I have problems with tone inflection. But this has – so I think this has two ramifications, right? One is this sort of cultural or dialectical ramification in the way that we speak about people who are seeking a better life. And we talked about how hard it is to leave home. And I don't think it's any easier for like a migrant farm worker to leave home than it is for a refugee. In some cases, it's even harder because it usually involves splitting a family. I have a 2-year-old. I have a husband. I'm going to be away from them for 3 days to be in Utah. And I'm super unhappy about that.
Yeah.
And that's not, you know, an indefinite period of time. And to say that there's somehow something less noble in that, I think is tragic and offensive and really problematic and a complete misread of the situation. The other problem is a legal problem, which is that because of the way that the convention was written, you know, 67 years ago at this point, a lot of people who fall into these other categories we talked about don't get any legal protection. So the good immigrant, bad immigrant thing serves really two purposes for the people that propagate it. One is that I think it's a way, and I think our president has politicized this in a really unfortunate manner, because I don't see immigration or refugees as a partisan issue at all. I think traditionally refugees have not been treated as a partisan issue. It's a strong part of the history of America to take in people who have nowhere else to go. The pilgrims came here because they couldn't practice their religion freely in the UK, and they came to the US.
But that's not true anymore. It's totally political now.
You're
baffled by that and you're disappointed by it,
It's become political. And I think immigration has been political for a long time, but I truly do not think that refugees were a political issue until Donald Trump responded to the Paris attacks by calling for a ban on Syrian refugees. which, by the way, were not perpetrated by refugees, right? And ISIS is using that against us. Like, the reason that we originally thought that the Paris attacks were perpetrated by refugees was because the Islamic State planted a fake passport of a Syrian refugee at the scene, and we walked right into that. You know, and
they're calling it the blessed ban.
They call the travel ban the blessed ban because it's the best thing that's ever happened for recruitment. I mean, we're playing right into their hands with our willingness to sort of make this political. But I think that, you know, the tradition of America has been that refugees really aren't politicized, and that the good immigrant, bad immigrant debate has been a way to mobilize people against a scapegoat who are unhappy, and also a way to try to cabin our responsibilities to the large numbers of people coming to our country, you know, because their lives are at risk for economic or war or health or climate or other reasons, and to say, well, we really only have an obligation to this subset of people because a bunch of folks 70 years ago, like, wrote up a definition that excludes this other group. And I think that's just complete BS.
I read one critique of your work recently, and I wanted to get you to respond.
No one critiques our work. It's perfect.
This is the director of the Immigration Reform Law Institute. This was in the New York Times.
Sounds very erudite.
And, of course, this group supports the president's immigration agenda. And they said that you don't believe immigration policy should put the national security of the country first. And that comes up a lot. And that – maybe I'll have you deal with that first. I want to get to this other idea that they say you think about this like a giant global welfare program. But deal with this national security part of that question first.
I mean, frankly, like, real talk, it is completely idiotic to think that banning refugees promotes national security. And anyone who knows anything about the way that U.S. national security actually works, who has thought about it for more than 5 seconds, can put the pieces together. I mean, and, you know, we talked about the blessed ban and how, like, this travel ban, like, I don't know if it's kept any terrorists out of the country. I certainly know that it's raised the ranks of ISIS by thousands of people. There's a ton of national security officials, including, you know, General McMaster, General Mattis, people who are serving in the government, who fought for a much higher refugee number this year because they recognize that it's critical to national security, but lost that debate. There was a really good piece in The New Yorker by Jonathan Blitzer about how Secretary Mattis and General McMaster were pushing for a higher refugee number along with Nikki Haley, because she's the one who has to deal with our foreign relationships with other countries, and then basically got overruled by Stephen Miller, whose only job is to look at domestic politics. Like, literally his title is that he runs the Domestic Policy Council, which is by definition inward facing. So, but I think that refugee advocates and pro-refugee people for so long have been making arguments that we should let in refugees because they're victims in the U.S. is nice, that we're sort of behind on the rhetoric of why admitting refugees is good for national security. So let me throw out three bullet points. Number one, these are the people fleeing ISIS.
Yeah.
If we are serious about stopping ISIS, we have to help the people that are fleeing ISIS and not discriminate against them in a way that makes it easier for ISIS to recruit. Number two, the biggest risk of refugees fleeing Syria, I think, is actually to our allies in the Middle East region. The population of Lebanon has gone from, well, not that Lebanon is necessarily a U.S. ally, but, you know, we do work with them. Jordan is certainly a U.S. ally. Turkey is still a U.S. ally, you know, and you can ask some questions about that, but it is, right?
Right.
Like, the strain that the millions of refugees have put on the infrastructure of these countries is immense. And the U.S. has to be able to demonstrate to these countries that we're a good ally and that we're not just using them to fly planes out of their military bases to bomb Raqqa, but that we're willing to do our share of burden sharing and the humanitarian results of the Syrian civil war. And finally, I think it's really damaging our credibility with our Western allies who, you know, millions of refugees are going into Europe. The U.S. has tried to set an example. For every year since 1980, the U.S. has resettled more refugees than every other country in the world combined. And I think us stepping back from this is clearly part of a larger abdication of U.S. leadership in the world. It's been obvious that that's happening with this administration in a wide number of foreign policy areas. And that's dangerous because it creates a vacuum. And the people who step into the vacuum are China and Russia. So those would be my three talking points for people who think that, like, taking in refugees is more dangerous than not taking in refugees.
How many talking points do you have for the argument that you're treating the immigration system like a giant global welfare program?
I mean, I guess my first thing is I would be like, what is wrong with that? which I said to you during the break, and then your quip back was spoken like a true socialist, which I'm actually not a socialist, contrary to popular belief. I think the free market works pretty well. But
I don't actually think you're a socialist.
I mean, anyone can think whatever they want about me. You know, I have that luxury because I have an American passport and I don't have to flee yet. But I don't think it's a global welfare program. I mean, there's 65 million refugees in the world and the U.S. was trying to take in 100,000 of them. That's a pretty small drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
It's a really tiny drop in the bucket compared to the U.S. population. And there also have been now all kinds of studies demonstrating that refugees are net beneficial to our economy, that over time, refugees generate. And I think it's crass to look at it in terms of revenue. But if you want to make an argument about social welfare and refugees, every study that's actually been done, including the one that the government commissioned themselves and then attempted to suppress, as was reported, I think, by the Wall Street Journal or possibly the New York Times, but, you know, someone that we kind of trust, has found that refugees are net beneficial to the economy. And the other sort of qualitative point I want to make on that, and this gets back to what I was saying earlier about refugees being such tenacious survivors, is that, I'm not an economist, but my impression is that, like, the industrial jobs are mostly leaving America, and there's not a lot we can do about that, right? They're being done by robots. They're being done in China. They're being done in India. And so what America is trying to promote as, like, the next phase of our economy is this idea of entrepreneurship, right? You have, like, startups and the small business, and all of these are forms of entrepreneurship. And I'm telling you, like, there is no better test of how entrepreneurial you are than whether you can escape a civil war.
Right.
The people who come here are an incredibly self-selecting group who are the most entrepreneurial, like, tenacious, hardworking, creative-minded folks I've ever met. And, like, that is what this economy needs.
Because, like, they didn't just sit there and take it from the oppression. They did something about it.
Not only did they do something about it, they did something really hard and they succeeded.
Becca Heller is with us, the director and co-founder of the International Refugee Assistance Project. Tonight at 7 o'clock, she's going to be on the campus of the University of Utah at the S.J. Quinney College of Law for a conversation with an Iraqi immigrant and caseworker, Yusuf Al-Tamimi. And you can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We also invite you to watch a short film that we made a month ago or so, profiles refugees in our community trying to make a fresh start at Lazee's Kitchen. It's called A Kitchen Can Take You Back. You can find all of that at radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back for some final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Becca Heller. She's the director and the co-founder of the International Refugee Assistance Project in Utah tonight, actually. We'll give you details about her her speech tonight, conversation tonight at radiowest.org. So one of the things you've said is that refugee intake is immigration policy, but it's also foreign policy. So as you're thinking about, I mean, we've talked a little bit about how your sense of what our obligation is as a country. What's like the foreign policy concept that you think about is the most appropriate? You know, are you a realist? Are you an interventionist? Are you an isolationist? I mean, how do you think about like foreign policy in that sense?
I haven't, you know, those are all pretty developed schools of international relations theory, and I don't fully buy into any of them. And also, I'm not tasked with making our foreign policy. I think the honest answer is probably that each situation calls for a bit of a different approach.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I think there are situations that call for intervention, and there are situations that call for deterrence, and there are situations that call for just like taking a break and having a beer and sitting this one out.
Right.
Which I suppose you could call isolationism.
But you don't buy the big labels. They don't really work for you.
I think it's crazy to think that any singular approach will be effective in every foreign policy context.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just it works really nicely on paper. And maybe it works really nicely during the Cold War, which is when all of those theories were really developed.
Yeah.
When the foreign policy of the world sort of just boiled down to like two main superpowers and how they dealt with each other. But that's not what the world looks like anymore.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that you have to keep in mind is, you know, if we view the main foreign policy threat to us as terrorism, that's not a nation state. I mean, it's often sponsored or supported by nation states, but the whole breakdown, I think, in international relations theory, and we're getting a little academic here, but, you know, I think that it assumes that you're dealing with the nation state and that the state is a rational actor and that terrorist groups are neither of those things. So when you're talking about foreign policy and keeping a world safe when the biggest threat to the world is terrorism, and I would argue that the biggest threat to the world is, in fact, climate change, and that ought to be part of our foreign policy. And I know I've dropped that a couple of times now, but like, you know, I think that it doesn't simplify in that way. Like,
yeah.
You have to be able to have like a nuanced view, and you have to have a toolbox that has a lot of tools in it. And certainly like the deterrence and the beer and the diplomacy are all parts of those tools, but you have to know like what combination to use when, and you have to be flexible enough that you can have an open mind to say, okay, here's a foreign policy situation. What do we have available to deal with it? And what makes sense in this context?
Yeah.
Which is why I'm running for president.
So we've talked about what an immigration system is not supposed to look like. What have you thought about, like, systemically? I mean, you hate inefficiency. You've looked at the system. You've heard like endless stories now about this tortuous screening process, the way it works, you know, these mythological wait lists. I mean, how is it supposed to work? Have you figured that out yet?
Yes, I have all the answers. I've written them down in a book that I've buried in upstate New York that someone's going to find in 150. That was my Utah joke for you.
Bum-bum.
Sorry.
It's a good one.
Thanks.
Good one.
I tried to cut it off before it alienated too many people. No, I mean, I think there's a big answer to that. There's a practical answer and there's a theoretical answer. I think the easiest practical answer, there was an immigration reform bill put together by a bipartisan group of 8 senators in, I want to say 2012, but I might have that wrong. And it was a really good bill. Like, there were things in it that I didn't love. There was a little something in it for everyone to not love.
Yeah.
But I think, by and large, it dealt with a lot of the major problems that we're facing in our immigration system. It did great things for refugees. It did great things for asylum seekers. It created a path to sort of legality and citizenship for the 11.3 million people who are undocumented. It beefed up border security, which is nice for everyone. And it passed the Senate. And then was sort of dead on arrival in the House. So I think the shortest, easiest, practical answer for what would you like to see done for U.S. immigration policy would be like, pick up the Senate bill and try again. It wasn't perfect, but honestly, like, this is a representative democracy, and
yep,
we're never going to do anything perfect. I think the broader answer is that when you look at, I want to also touch on this whole like merit-based thing, because that's resurfaced.
Yeah. Yesterday.
Yes. I mean, the terrorist attack in New York was a block from my husband's office. Like, it's personal to us. Like,
yeah.
I'm I don't like terrorism. It scares me. I don't want it to happen on U.S. soil. But I want to step back and just say that, like, you can't look at immigration as an isolated phenomenon. And I think that a lot of what was happening is that people were looking at immigrants who were already in the U.S. and saying, how do we deal with this, without looking at the root causes that caused the flow of immigration in the first place. Yeah. And I would suggest that colonialism has an awful lot to do with immigration all over the world. That most of the so-called like Western or Northern or whatever geographical label is politically appropriate now countries spent like quite a bit of time between, say, the 18th and the 20th century just like pillaging all of the natural resources, including the human resources of like Latin America and Africa. And now we're totally shocked that people are fleeing those places because there's no way to like make ends meet and there's conflict over the limited resources they are. I think that when it comes to history, our memory is very short, right? I mean, you could compare Afghanistan to Vietnam, right? There's all sorts of comparisons to make, but I just think you can't separate out the global flow of humans from what we've done to make countries uninhabitable for the last 200 years. And look in the mirror and keep a straight face.
So we're almost out of time, about a minute left. So I want to ask you this, because I want to you talk about this. We have this tradition. It seems like you're talking about it as something that's kind of embedded in who we are, of taking refugees in. And it seems like you're worried that that's going to possibly go away.
It is going away.
So do you think we have the cultural? Forget the political part of it. Do we have the cultural will to keep this tradition, or you think it's the stakes are pretty bad right now?
I hope we do. I mean, I hope that there are people out there who love Donald Trump and maybe will vote for him again, but still think that we have an obligation to let people fleeing persecution come to America and start over, and to realize that we, you know, manifest destiny means that the country's really big and that there's space for a lot of different people, and that your ancestors came over as immigrants fleeing something, right? Like, Utah was settled by people fleeing religious persecution, right? Surely there's room in Utah for other people fleeing a different kind of religious persecution. And so I would say, regardless of what your political persuasion is, like, my hope is that part of what it means to you to be an American is that people fleeing persecution for something that they shouldn't have to change can come here and find a safe place to call home.
Becca Heller. She's going to be at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law tonight. You can get details about that on our website. She's the director and co-founder of the International Refugee Assistance Project. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We're directed today by Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.